Hi, everyone. Welcome to the OTRU and PTCC webinar, Support for Workers Who Smoke, Findings from the Ontario Workplace Cessation Demonstration Projects. My name is Sarah Pinder, and I'm with PTCC, and I'm here today with Dr. Pamela Kaufman, Tracy Borland, and Rita Look, who are going to be speaking on this topic today with us. I'll take care of a little bit of business before we get started on the call. Just to tell you a bit about how to comment or ask questions on today's presentation. On your screen, you're going to be seeing a chat box in the left-hand corner of the webinar window. You'll be able to enter your questions or comments to the presenters in that chat box. Now, the presenters have indicated that they want to hold the questions until the end of the presentation, hold responding to the questions till the end of the presentation. Please feel free to ask your questions throughout the presentation just so you can keep them top of mind and make sure you write them down so you're not scrambling at the end to remember what you wanted to ask about. But we will be asking, we will be responding to those questions later on in the call, most likely. And I will also I should say that the lines will be muted during this call, so the only way to participate in the conversation is through the chat box as well. And now I'm going to introduce our speakers who are with us today. We have Dr. Pam Kaufman, who is a scientist at the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit. She's also an assistant professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto, and her interests are in smoking behavior and smoke-free policy research and evaluation. And we also have Tracy Borland joining us today, who's a research officer at the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit, and her interests are in smoking cessation for special populations and youth and young adult smoking. And the third person joining us on the call today is Rita Look. And Rita is a research officer at the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit as well. And her interests are in the economics of tobacco control, contraband cigarettes, and tobacco control indicators. Dr. Pam Kaufman is going to start us off today, so I will pass the microphone over to her.
Thank you, Sarah. So it's a great pleasure to be here speaking to all of you about our evaluation of the workplace cessation demonstration project. Some of you may be more familiar than others about these projects, so I'm going to just do a very brief introduction about the projects themselves. So the projects were, between 2012 and 2014, the Ontario Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care provided one-time funding to 11 public health units in Ontario, and these health units represented 19 health unit partners, to implement demonstration projects in workplaces within their regions. And the purpose of the projects were to reduce the present levels of smoking in industry sectors that have high smoking rates. That includes construction, mining, manufacturing, and hospitality and service. And we know that not only do these sectors have high smoking rates, but often the workers within these sectors may be less likely to seek cessation support within their communities. And there's low uptake of cessation support and other types of wellness programs overall. So OTRU has been working with the Smoke Free Ontario partners to evaluate the workplace cessation demonstration projects in collaboration with the University of Waterloo, public health units, and workplace leaders and partner agencies, including Smokers Helpline and the STOP program at CAMH. So really what we wanted to do is collect data to understand how workplace settings, and that includes their unique social and organizational contexts, influence the feasibility, implementation, and outcomes of workplace cessation programs that were implemented through the project. So we wanted to know what really helps or facilitates and what challenges the development and implementation of the quit smoking programs in workplaces, what challenges and facilitators did the participants encounter when they were trying to quit within the workplaces, and what workplace quit smoking programs are really effective for different employees within different circumstances. So these are actually quite complex questions, because what we have are different levels of factors at the intervention level, at the sector level, the organizational level, and the individual level. And often these factors are intertwined. So if an individual is having trouble quitting because they are encountering stress within their personal or work lives, that workplace stress, for instance, can be influenced at the organizational and the sector level as well. So these are very closely intertwined. So it's very complex to tease out what exactly is working best in what situations. But that was our goal. And I wanted to point out that quitting is only one indicator of effectiveness. There are many other indicators. So we didn't just look at quitting outcomes. We looked at reducing smoking, we looked at reach, and we looked at uptake. So reach and uptake were particularly important because, again, we're talking about workers, smokers within workplaces that have high smoking prevalence, and they may have low uptake of interventions overall. And they may be less likely to seek out quit smoking supports within their communities outside of their workplaces. We also looked at intervention delivery, and we looked at context within the workplace, the specific challenges within different types of workplaces. So in terms of our evaluation, we had three phases to the evaluation. We started off with a baseline needs assessment, where we the Health Units surveyed employers and employees in order to tailor their intervention programs. And then there was there were intake surveys for people who were enrolling into the program. Then those individuals were followed up at 6 months and at 12 months. And we also had brief check-ins with the public health units and with employers. And in addition to that, we conducted case studies to gather some more rich qualitative data that would help to inform what was going on within the sectors and within specific workplace situations. We interviewed employers and public health unit staff. We held focus groups with employees. And we actually held interviews with employees as well. And we interviewed our provincial stakeholders. And because this evaluation had a very strong integrated knowledge exchange component, we had an evaluation working group with representatives from our stakeholders and the health units who were involved. And we also had a workplace cessation learning collaborative that PTCC hosted in order to allow us to provide feedback back to the health units as the data was emerging. Okay, so there's a question about the brief check-ins and what they entailed. So for our brief check-in surveys with the public health units and the employers, we had a survey that they completed online, and we would it was basically done through Key Survey, and we'd ask some questions about what their challenges were, what was helping them to implement their program, whether there were any major barriers that they were encountering, and generally how things were working out for them on the ground, and any early impacts that they were encountering within the program, successes or challenges. So in terms of the intervention, they were, in some respects, the interventions were quite similar across all of the projects. So almost all of the projects except for one had NRT, and some had prescription medication, but there was only one or two that were able to do that. But they almost all had NRT, and they almost all had some form of counseling. Most of the counseling was brief contact and smokers' helpline and group counseling, and a few had more intense one-on-one counseling. There was also a variety of self-help materials within the health units. Some of these were developed for the program, some were existing, and there was a lot of promotional materials and activities to inform employees about the program, and some of the health units trained management and staff within the workplaces to provide peer support. And there was also, in a couple of cases, some consultation around smoke-free policy that was existing at the workplace and how to enhance that or enforce it. And again, just to point out that the sectors really had different challenges and barriers to implementing programs. They were somewhat different, each of them. So, for example, with manufacturing, there was it was one few sectors that had a fairly good balance between males and females within the workplaces, a little more males within the sample. And manufacturing had more of an aging, long-term workforce, so there was a much higher permanence of place. There was more of a sense of family and community. However, people were often on shift work, and sometimes the tasks that employees were undertaking could be a little boring or tedious. And then with construction, there was mostly male workers, and there was a very strong smoking culture among some of the trades, and lots of opportunities to smoke on site, and permanence of place is quite low. And then with hospitality, that was one of the few that had a higher female population, and again, a lot of shift work and seasonal work, and permanence of place was quite low. And then we had primary industry with a high percentage of male population, again, in some cases a strong smoking culture and a lot of shift work, and sometimes remote work in places where people would be working for a couple of weeks on and then working off-site or going back to their homes for a couple of weeks. In terms of reach, we reached the majority of the workplaces were in construction, followed by manufacturing. And in terms of participants, most of the participants were within manufacturing and construction as well. And among the 668 participants that completed an intake survey, so were enrolled in the program, most were male. And the mean age was 42 years. So the majority, well, almost half, actually, of the participants were more than 45 years old. And almost all of them, 98%, were daily smokers, and they had a very high nicotine addiction. So they were smoking on average 21 cigarettes per day, and 73% smoked within 30 minutes of waking.
There's just a couple quick questions from the audience, just to clarify a couple things there. There's a question about who the provincial stakeholders were for this project, and another question about, for clarification, about what primary industry means as well. Those two might be useful just to elaborate on now.
Absolutely. So our provincial stakeholders, we had the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, we had Smokers Helpline, CCO, and we had the STOP program at CAMH. And then, of course, all of the health units that participated in the program. And then in terms of primary industry, that refers, so we had a site that was in mining and a site that was in forestry products. So those were our two primary industry sites. So they were industries that
there were
resource extraction, and they were in remote areas.
Thanks for clarifying those things.
No problem. So now I'm going to hand it over to Tracy, and she's going to talk about some of the qualitative high insights that we learned.
Great. Thank you, Pam. As Pam noted, I'm going to take you through some implementation findings, focusing on three key points. So workplace or employer engagement, program uptake, and barriers or facilitators to reaching tobacco-related goals as experienced by employees. And just to note, this is primarily based on qualitative data from interviews and focus groups, but also from qualitative data in the 6-month and 12-month follow-up surveys. So engaging workplaces. So what really influenced an employer's decision to provide cessation support to employees and basically to participate in the demonstration project? Well, employers really valued interventions that were generally low resource intensity in that they didn't have to spend a significant amount of organizational resources on the project. And they really valued projects that didn't really disrupt the workflow of the day. And this was a very important consideration for those working in the construction sector. They also place a really high value on the opportunity to provide staff with free nicotine replacement therapy and other public health services. And other things that facilitated or really convinced employers to participate in the program was presenting the business case for smoking cessation, but also really being able to implement the program soon after the initial discussions with workplaces, because priorities really do shift quite quickly.
We just have a comment. Can you speak a bit loud?
Yeah, sure.
And closer to the phone.
Yeah. So another aspect that appeared to facilitate employee participation in the intervention was really having an established wellness culture. There were some organizations with very strong wellness cultures, and they tended to be larger manufacturing companies. And this facilitated adoption of services by those with wellness cultures because they probably are more likely to understand the importance of offering cessation support or wellness initiatives to their employees. And they might also already have some capacity to do so. So that being said, these programs might also actually be a way to show to senior management the importance of providing wellness initiatives to employees. And this is actually the case with of a smaller organization where the human resource professional really used this program as a springboard to offer other health and wellness support. And that being said, having a dedicated workplace champion was also important for obtaining but also maintaining senior management buy-in. So now just to focus on a sector-specific barrier, so what happens when you don't have buy-in across a sector, which was the case of this lead public health practitioner working on a construction sector demonstration project. So as noted in the quote, the practitioner thought she had convinced a large number of health and safety coordinators about the importance and feasibility of doing cessation on construction sites, but for a variety of reasons, including the ones that she mentioned here, but also because it was a relatively novel idea within the construction sector locally, and also because of the cultural norms in which smoking is embedded within the sector, she really didn't have that buy-in that she thought. So to overcome this challenge, this public health unit really adopted and really valued a participatory approach and a teamwork approach. They worked really closely with health and safety coordinators and continuously and formally engaged employees to ensure that a program was really culturally relevant, but also tailored to the local work sites. And as you can see in this quote, the workplace leaders were actually very, very appreciative of this process and their level of engagement in informing the development of the program. And that being said, it's really important to note that the time that was needed to build these partnerships and maintain relationships, and I believe this particular health unit spent a solid 6 months prior to the demonstration project really working closely with higher-level construction organizations such as health and safety associations and union trade counselors to build trust within the sector and whatnot. So now just moving on to program uptake. So what really, I think I skipped a slide. So program uptake. So what really influenced employees' decision to participate in the initiative? Well, the opportunity to obtain a free NRT. That was the main attraction. It was really an incentive to make a quit attempt, even amongst those who weren't actually contemplating quitting. And offering different forms of NRT was important, as Pam noted, because the population that the public health units were targeting were generally older, long-term smokers who had tried quitting before and had probably used the patch and maybe had perceived it to be ineffective, so and perhaps looking for different pharmacotherapy options. Also, it's important to note that the demonstration projects were a way to reach those employees who might not have access to benefits, such as hospitality and service sector employees, but also to help those employees who had already exhausted their company benefits. Employees also really valued that just the sole availability of cessation support within their workplaces. And this is because job characteristics made it really difficult for many to access support outside of the work setting, such as night shifts in manufacturing, transient jobs in construction, long hours across the board, remote work in manufacturing and whatnot. And just really the logistics, that flexibility, so of actually offering support within the work setting, so offering it at multiple times, different locations to reach different shifts, and whatnot, and also allowing employees to participate during their shifts also facilitated uptake. But that may not be an option for a lot of workplaces that may not have the resources to provide that release time for employees to participate during their shifts. So this was one example of a smaller organization. And what they really did was, to overcome this barrier, as you can see in this quote, they adopted a peer support model in that they trained staff as wellness coordinators to reach those employees who couldn't attend the lunch group sessions, but also didn't really want to give up their own time to participate in the program. And this tended to work well in this relatively smaller manufacturing organization and was actually considered a reason for why they experienced an increase in uptake in their intervention later on. So other factors that facilitated program uptake, public health presence. So public health is really considered a third-party provider, somebody to talk to, an expert in smoking cessation. And people really valued specific qualities about these public health practitioners, and those were that they were trusting, non-judgmental. They really valued their dynamic and passionate nature, and that they were confident and friendly. And it was really another layer, public health presence added another layer of program promotion in that their presence kind of brought a reality to the access to support and that support was actually available. And then contests and challenges, specifically those with significant financial incentives, were really considered ways to promote program uptake and generate interest in quitting, but also involve employees, smokers and non-smokers alike, to create a supportive environment. And it was also a way to alleviate perhaps any animosity towards smokers should they be perceived to receiving preferential treatment because their health needs were being addressed and non-smokers were not. And here another challenge that was quite prevalent throughout the manufacturing sector was workplace climate, or in particularly low morale due to things like layoffs, job insecurity, cutbacks to employee benefits, low job control and whatnot. And this might be problematic for uptake because employees might question the permanence of cessation support in less secure environments. And job insecurity or might be a barrier to making a quit attempt because of the perceived stressors related to potentially being unemployed. On the flip side to that, offering a sustained cessation program, some had noted, was a way to build or perhaps repair trust issues, because it would be a way to show employees that the employer genuinely cares about their health and well-being. Now, hospitality. As Pam had indicated, those who worked with hospitality and service sector organizations had more difficulty reaching employees. And there was a variety of reasons. One would be, for example, the physical space of the workplace, the part-time and casual status of employees, the variety of shift schedules they're working with, shifting priorities due to economic sensitivity, and also a seasonality of sector was also important consideration, and just the younger nature of the workforce relative to the other sectors. However, Both regions noted that if they were to redo this project again or work on this in the future, they would take a more collaborative approach and target higher-level sector organizations, approach tourism boards, for example. And that's kind of similar to the construction project I spoke of earlier. And just ideas that they spoke about, they could have sector-wide contests and really having consistent support messaging throughout the year. And it might be a way to reach employees in hospitality and service sector who work for multiple workplaces, which was the experience in one demonstration project. And now, just really quickly, I'll go through some facilitators to quitting that emerged out of the qualitative findings. So what helped employees really meet their tobacco-related goals? Health practitioner support and NRT, access to NRT came out quite strongly. Having coworker and partner support, as well as management support. Personal factors, such as being ready to quit, that was a very strong theme, as well as being mentally prepared. And employees also listed various strategies, such as physical activity, eating, avoiding alcohol and caffeine, keeping busy, and avoiding other smokers at the workplace, for example. And some challenges to quitting, stress, this came out very strongly, as Rita will speak to in a second, stress in the work environment, and but also personal stress in their personal lives. On the flip side, individual factors, so I don't have enough willpower or I just wasn't ready to quit. Use of other substances and weight gain, so replacing smoking with eating, and other smokers in the work environment and in the home environment, and particularly partners. And just to end this section, the smoke break. So the smoke break was a barrier or a significant barrier challenge to quitting. So smoke breaks serve different purposes across the sectors, but most recently it was noted or described as the social aspect was most frequently described and related to the smoke break. However, new break time activities, as Rita will note, was a predictor of smoking absence, so really replacing the smoke break with other activities such as you will see in the second quote here. And I want to just end with this quote because it not only shows how important new break time activities were for this gentleman working in manufacturing to help him stay smoke-free, but also how structures within workplaces can also influence one's ability to do so. So really how the local context can really influence cessation outcomes. Now I'm just going to pass things along to Rita, and she's going to go through some of the quantitative data that's coming out of the evaluation.
Today I'm going to talk about the quit ways and what happened to those who will continue to smoke in the follow-up, and also talking about the predictor of quitting that generated from our quantitative data analysis. Our survey began with 668 participants, and 319 of them went on to complete a 6-month follow-up, and 109 of them went on to complete a 12-month follow-up. And you can see there are 36 participants actually. They complete the 12-month follow-up without complete the 6-month follow-up. So if we are looking at the data that they for all the participants that they participate in all the three wave of the survey, there are 109 participants. In the first question in the follow-up, we asked the participants what were the resources and methods that they used to quit in between the intake and the 6-month follow-up. And you can see the, in the chart that 86% of them said that they use NRT. You might start asking, you know, how many people quit? Well, it depends on what do you mean by quit. Here I saw the outcome measures of quitting that our company uses. The first one is the 7-day point preference abstinence. The definition of this is the percent of participants in the follow-up who reported that they did not smoke in the 7 days prior to the follow-up. So, for example, if you look at the second column, in the six-month follow-up, we have 319 participants, and 96 of them reported they did not smoke in the past 7 days prior to the follow-up. So we have 30% as the 7-day quit rate. So similar reasoning, apart from the 30-day point preference, that means that is the definition of the percent of participants at the follow-up who did not smoke in the 30 days prior to the follow-up. So here we have for the six-month follow-up, we have 27% as the 30-day point preference abstinence rate. We go further to have a more, you can say, more serious definition that we require people actually not smoking all through the 6 months between intake and the 6 month follow-up, for example, then we see that we have 44 people said so in the 6 month follow-up, so that make up the 6 month continuous abstinence rate as 14%. So same method, same definition we can apply to the participants who completed 12-month follow-up. So you can see that we have the 26% 7-day point preference, 23% for the 30-day point preference, and 21% for the 6-month continuous abstinence.
Rita, we've got one question that I think will be fairly quick to ask. Were you surprised to see higher rates at 12 months?
Higher rates? No, actually, not surprised, because that reflects people are moving to the, I mean, those who, for example, in the 6 months, follow-up, they may just quit for 30 days or quit 7 days, but in the long term, they move to the 6 month continuous abstinence, and you can see that why the for the 6 month continuous abstinence, actually, they increase.
Thanks.
Here is also the quit rate, but now we saw by business sectors. And you see the quit rate varies by business sector. Well, one thing you will question is there any association between, you know, sectors and quit rates? But actually, there's no statistical significant relationship between the sectors and the quit rate. So we can do the same for the quit rate at the 12-month follow-up by sector. And you can see that some of the sector primary industry, for example, there's no one participated in the 12-month follow-up. How do we summarize the transition of quitting and smoking across the three waves of data? There are many ways to do it. One way, for me, I use a more strict sense of abstinence. I did not allow grace period. So for those who keep saying that they did not move over the 12 months in between intake and the 12-month follow-up, I would classify them as those who practice continuous abstinence. And on the other end, those who keep smoking all through the 12 months, then I classify them as persistent smokers. And the rest of them are the intermittent smokers. That means they quit or smoke in some period over the 12 months. And you can see that among the 109 participants who completed three waves of the data, we have 12% are continuous who practice continuous abstinence, and 22% are intermittent smokers, and 66% are persistent smokers. And now we are going to see how the smoking status change across waves. In particular, we are looking at the changes between the baseline to 6 month follow-up, and then later for the baseline to 12 month follow-up. Here we have the 19 participants in the 6 month follow-up. We can see that 57% are daily smokers. But then we will have a question: is how we wanted to see how does it change? How does smoking status at the baseline compare to their smoking status at the base? How their smoking status at the follow up compared to their smoking status at the baseline? And you can see that the daily smoking, the percent of daily smoking goes down from 98% to 57%, while the occasional and former smokers percent goes up in the follow up. That just indicate people are moving to reduce smoking or even quitting. Similar pattern for the 12 month data. You can see also here the daily smoking reduced from 97% to 63%, while the occasional and former from 2% to 46%. After seeing all this smoking status now, we wanted to know what happened to those who continue to smoke in the follow-up. And did they reduce their smoking? The answer is yes. For example, in the 6-month follow-up, among the 223 smokers who continue to smoke in the follow-up, 81% of them said that they reduced the number of cigarette smokes in between the intake and the 6-month follow-up. And actually, if we look at the number of cigarettes they reported they smoke on the day they smoke, actually the average number of cigarettes they smoke reduced from 21 in the baseline to only 30 cigarettes in the 6-month follow-up. And we did the same similar analysis for the 12-month follow-up. For the 108 participants in the 12-month follow-up, 75% of them say that they reduced the number of cigarettes they smoke between the 6 and 12-month follow-up. And also the average number of cigarettes smoked also reduced from 21 to 40. You can see that, well, our workplace intervention have kind of people quit, have those who continue to smoke reduce their smoking. And actually those interventions also encourage those who continue to smoke to engage in quitting behavior. For example, in the 6 months for the about 80% of those who remain smoke said that they made a quit attempt. But if you look at what they did in the baseline, only 34 of them made a quick attempt in the baseline. So you can see that the engagement in quick attempt actually increased from between the baseline and the 6 month follow up. And the same pattern here for the 12 month follow up. 67% of smokers said that they made a quick attempt in the 12 month follow up. But if you look at the baseline, only 33% of them made a quick attempt. Now we go to look at the predictor of quitting behavior. Why I put up the workplace characteristics, and you know, Pam and Tracy has mentioned that, you know, workplace characteristics actually kind of facilitate quitting. So we put into hypothesis testing. When we do the data analysis, we incorporate these 10 indicators of workplace characteristics and wanted to analyze what are the direction and the magnitude of the effect on quitting. And so far, we found that the impact of these 10 workplace characteristics actually match our expectation. For example, workplace with a higher commitment facilitate quitting, and also workplace with higher, that is a workplace permanence. That means workplace is with a long-term employee and stable condition also facilitate quitting. Now, first of all, we look at the predictors for the 7-day and 30-day porn preference abstinence. And I will explain later why we have to separate from the 6 months of abstinence later. First of all, we note the data analysis indicated that those participants who report the use of smokers helpline to quit or use contest or competition to quit are more likely to quit. And also, those participants who say that waking as a barrier to quitting also more likely to quit. And then we also have those, well, that is very obvious, those who report that no challenge to quit, of course, they are more likely to quit. So it's a kind of data-driven. And another important indicator is the low level of nicotine addiction. Like people who smoke 10 cigarettes per day are more likely to quit than those who smoke 30 cigarettes a day. So another indicator is those who claim that they smoke because of bore at the intake, and data show that they are also more likely associated with quitting. So then we will look at the other side. On the other hand, those people who say that depression or stress are their barrier to quit, we find that they are less likely to quit. And also those who say that they use other tobacco products and also associated with less likely to quit. Then we go to the predictor of quitting for the 6 months continuous abstinence. We have to separate it because this is a long-term decision, so the mechanic of this predictor will be a little bit different from the previous two, and also there are some, because there are less quitters under this category, so you also create some data analysis issue, but I just don't want to talk about it here. But anyhow, we found that those who said they use new break or lunchtime activity to quit, we found that they are more likely to associate with 6 months continuous abstinence. And also, those who report no challenges barely to quit also more likely to quit. So now it goes back to Pam.
Thanks, Rita. So now we're almost at the finish line, and I'm going to just wrap up with a few of our key learnings, because we did present a lot of information, and we want to make sure we leave you with some of our key findings that we think that are primary to consider when you're implementing these types of programs in these types of blue-collar workplace settings. So first of all, in terms of development and implementation, it's so important to make it easy for employers to participate. So this means having minimal disruption of workflow, and Tracy referred to some of these things earlier. So having minimal disruption to workflow, being able to respond to what organizational resources are available, but not putting too much onto the workplace in terms of providing resources. However, interestingly, we did find that there is a need for a workplace to provide some resources or some sort of investment in the project in order to show employees that they are really invested in this wellness program. So that could be something as simple as providing some support for communicating the program within the workplace, and for some of the larger workplaces, they were able to provide a little more than that. And then in terms of workplace industry and commitment, the workplace or industry commitment, it's important to ensure that the employer has buy-in throughout the program and maintains their interest through the program. So making sure that the intervention remains at one of the top priorities of the workplace. In order to do that, the people working with the workplaces really need to understand the employer's motivation in the first place. It's also important to have senior management support. That was very important for the uptake with among employees. And having a dedicated workplace champion definitely was a positive facilitator for the program. In terms of reach and uptake, I think the programs reached 668 smokers. And I think we have to keep in mind that these are smokers that have very high smoking rates and low participation in interventions overall. And they may be more motivated to quit when something, an intervention such as this comes into their workplace, because they're at a life stage where they're thinking about their health. They might have more declining health. They might be thinking about retirement, about spending time with their family and their grandchildren. So this it's also important to understand the motivation of people working within these environments. Also making sure that the implementation, that the intervention works well with the schedules of the workers. If you're on shift work and you're working a very physically exhausting job and you get home late at night, you're probably not going to go into the community to seek out an intervention. But if it's in your workplace, you may be more likely to access it. And, of course, if a workplace is able to provide release time for employees to participate, then, you know, that certainly facilitates uptake. And also keeping in mind that there's ecological influences at the workplace level. So although NRT and behavioral supports are used in many programs as quit smoking interventions, by providing these within the workplace but also working on the workplace environment, the climate, the morale, looking at considering the workplace culture, workplace smoking policy. So all of these pieces go into helping to maximize the benefits of using these types of interventions. And again, particularly among this population group. And then finally, in terms of what appears to work, going back to this diagram, it's still a complex question. However, looking at the qualitative and the quantitative data, we've been able to synthesize some of this and come up with factors that appear to work in these different situations. And these factors, Tracy has already gone through a lot of them, as well as Rita, but looking at the individual level, particularly with something like depression and stress being a major barrier for individuals trying to quit, and then going to the organization level and saying, okay, how can we address those types of barriers at the organizational level, such as stress? How can we provide wellness programs that address weight gain, for example, that people may find as a barrier? How can a sector help to change the smoking culture within their environments? And then, of course, the interventions can also provide supports in these areas to help the individuals. So these are all a way to look at the smoking interventions within blue-collar workplaces holistically. And then finally, I wanted to leave with this very positive note that 98% of respondents would recommend this program to others. So that was a very positive response as well. In terms of knowledge exchange, all of the tools that we use for data collection, as well as the dissemination products that we'll be producing, will be available on the OTRA website, but also through a link to the PTCC's new website for workplace cessation, and they're going to speak about this in a moment. We also, part of that will include some newsletters that we'll be producing, and of course our final evaluation report, and we'll be presenting at the topic conference this Friday as well. And I think I just skipped that slide. Let me just go back. There we go. And I'd just like to acknowledge the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care and staff at CAMH, Smokers Helpline and PTCC, and all of the public health units and the participants and the people working on this at OTRU and at the other partner organizations for their support in this project. And now I'm going to pass it. We've reached the finish line. I'm going to pass it on to Sarah, and hopefully we can answer some of your questions.
Great. I know there are, thanks so much, Pam. I know there are a number of questions on the line, so I will keep our preview of our website short and sweet, but we just wanted to let you know that PTCC has a new workplace resources page. You'll see the link to the website address on the right-hand corner of your screen right now. And this page will have tools and resources to support development, implementation, and evaluation of workplace smoking cessation interventions. So there's lots of resources available for you on that website. You can check it out on our webpage, ptcc-cfc.on.ca. Under the resources section, there's a section called workplace resources. So check that out. That is brand new and for you to use. And now I want to jump right into the questions because I know that we have got a lot of questions from the audience. I also want to say, too, that if we don't get to your question today, there's been some pretty specific stuff asked as well. I'm going to put up Pam's contact information at the end of the call as well. Please feel free to get in touch with her directly if something hasn't been answered today, just because I know we do have a number of questions and we do have a brief amount of time to get through them all. So let's start with a question from Patricia Hewitt. The interventions used are the same ones employed by most public health units. So how would doing the same thing increase uptake with this project? Is it because you focus solely on specific industries?
Thank you for that question. Yes. So by doing this project and focusing in on these industries, we're focusing in on individuals that might not have accessed these interventions elsewhere. So this is a benefit to blue-collar workers specifically. And as Tracy mentioned in her qualitative piece, there are a lot of specific things that can be done within the sectors, within the workplaces, that will help to increase the uptake among these individuals, the smokers within these workplaces that might not have done so otherwise.
Thanks, Pam. And we have a question from Nick LaBelle. If memory serves, about half the employers didn't participate in the program. Why weren't they convinced? What were counterarguments to being involved with this program?
I can answer that. And I just wanted to note the report has a lot more detail than what we glazed over today, but some of your questions might be answered in that. But just really briefly, kind of the flip side of what I answered, I think for me what stands out when I think about the data, it was really timelines of the implementation. In some cases, it took longer to create programs and for a variety of factors at different levels. But also shifting workplace priorities, and this is really, there's a plethora of reasons from the workplace going into union contract negotiations, layoffs, as I had mentioned, renovations taking greater priority. So there was a lot of different reasons. And in the report, you'll be able to read about a lot of those specific to each of the sectors.
Thanks. And we have a question from Cheryl Seidenberg. Were e-cigarettes considered in the projects, and did they come into the conversation much during your study?
We did ask people about use of other tobacco products, including e-cigarettes, other tobacco products. And we did find that people who had used other tobacco products were not as successful at kind of back quitting. But I'm going to let Rita respond to that because she knows that data better.
I saw that using other tobacco products is associated with less likely to quit. However, we also asked among those who use other tobacco products for specific items. So far, the response to specific item is not so much. So, it's not much data.
Okay, so we have a question from Gail Sarbit. Was public health presence and communication face-to-face or via telephone? How often were these communications, and what were the incentives for people to complete the surveys?
It really varied. In some cases, particularly in construction sites, it was difficult sometimes to get onto the site. So NRT was mailed out to individuals. Mm-hmm. At other sites, NRT was offered, or other types of organizations such as manufacturing, the public health staff or practitioners were able to go onto the site and actually work with recruiting people on site and providing the NRT or any counseling on site. In some cases, there was some telephone counseling,
yeah.
Of course, with Smokers Helpline.
It really just depended on what the capacity of the what was feasible of doing in the workplace and what employees wanted as well. So it was really balancing those two fine lines. When I think about it, there was relatively less more intensive programs, such as individual counseling offered weekly and whatnot. There were a lot of group workshops at lunchtime and whatnot. So.
And maybe a bit of a follow-up question from Claire Joutre. When you say that public health was on the site, can you be more precise about what that exactly represented in terms of time?
As Pam was saying, in terms of time, it really just depended. So for construction, it was really you get on, you do your, you're there. You often on lunchtime, you could have like 10 minutes to talk to employees or whatnot. It really just depends on what the employer can afford to give you. Pam, did you want to add anything?
I think so. This points towards the importance of really collaborating closely with the employer and figuring out at the beginning what is feasible for that employer and the type of work that's going on at that site. So in some cases, it's an employer would be very generous in terms mm-hmm. of allowing people on a site to set up maybe even a booth in the cafeteria or something to talk about things, or
access to a health center mm-hmm. room to be able to be there Tuesdays and Wednesdays to do like 3 hours of counseling for employees to drop in. It really just depends. Yeah.
And then other sites, you'd have to go on and off very quickly. Mm-hmm. And, as Tracy said, over a lunch hour.
Yeah, it sounds like things varied a lot based on the relationships that were built. A question from Suzanne Gabby. Other than the quit challenges, what other promotions seem to have the biggest impact on participation?
I think there were so many factors that that influenced it together that I can't really think of one. For me, in some manufacturing sites, I think of the workplace morale and employees not wanting to participate due to things like that. There's just so many contextual factors. I can't think of them right now.
Yeah, it was really hard for us to narrow down the outcomes with some of these specific factors because the numbers got very small. If you try to pull out, any specific type of communication that was used within a workplace, you wouldn't have the numbers to really be able to link it to the outcome data. So we have to look at the communication and recruitment at a much higher level.
Okay, and a clarifying question. Someone would like to know what exactly a dedicated workplace champion is, what that term means.
Yeah, sure. Sorry for not being too clear in the presentation. So when I think about from the sector, so having a dedicated workplace champion is somebody who worked closely with the public health staff to really get the program moving and helping to get the program, getting senior management buy-in to do the program, but also getting it out there and creating a tailored one. So in construction, it was the health and safety coordinators that were very, very important. Public health that worked very closely with them. In manufacturing, human resources tended to be, and in mining and hospitality service, it was generally those who had a more human resource role. But also, if they had occupational health staff on site as well.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for answering that. I'm noticing the time as well and wanting to make sure we get out on time. I'm going to shortly be typing Pam's email address into the chat box here for further questions. You can contact her directly. What I'd like folks to do now, though, is if we could just do a brief check-in about whether people would be interested in a follow-up webinar on support for workers who smoke, which focuses on case studies from the field. So I'd like to know if you are interested, somewhat interested, or if you've had that information covered today and you're satisfied. If you're able to respond to the poll question now, I'd just love to get a sense of people's attitudes for a future follow-up webinar on workers who smoke. Okay, I'll give people maybe just another moment to weigh in, see if we can get a couple stragglers. Oh, and I guess it's time to wrap up. It's noon. Thank you for participating, and we really appreciate it. A link to our webinar survey is going to be emailed to you following this webinar. If you could fill that out and send that back to us, that would be appreciated. We're always looking to improve service delivery on these webinars. And thanks so much for more information. This is how to get in touch with us. Have a great afternoon, everyone, and thank you again to Dr. Pamela Kaufman, Tracy Borland, and Rita Look for joining us. I really appreciated your work today on the call. Thanks so much, everybody. Bye.